is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana, finishing up a brief series on theology of the cross that I've been doing this week. And today's session is about reading scripture in light of the cross, or as I sometimes call it, rereading. I'm a person who can't leave well enough alone. We go back and reread things over and over and over and find something different than what we expect or what we've always been told. My shirt today is sort of a symbol of not leaving well enough alone. This is that wonderful theme t-shirt that Dan Erlander designed, from which I stole my Bible study theme for 2 weeks earlier. But as I explained the first time I wore this in the Bible studies, yellow is not my color. My skin color doesn't go with yellow, nor does it go very well with that wonderful brown, that rich brown. So I had my daughter fix me a customized theme t-shirt. Sort of iconoclasm. I've thought of all sorts of analogies for what I'm doing today, including, you know, I don't live in a normal rhythm here at Holden Village. I shave in the afternoon or late in the morning, and then that left me today going up after eating my coffee, eating my muffin with coffee to go shave, but the lights were out. So I found myself shaving in the dark, which is sort of an analogy for doing a lot of theology. You sort of know where everything is, but you're using a sharp object.
In the dark.
In the dark, yeah. And then the lights came on just in time to show me all the places I had nicked myself. Fortunately, none of them required a piece of Kleenex. So anyway, I did bring along one other potential moment of forced hilarity in case none happened naturally. There's one of them that's sort of borderline theology of the cross, which is why I brought these. These have been around forever. Probably many of you have seen them on the internet. But these are supposedly metaphors from middle school English papers that didn't quite work. Saved by, I presume, well-meaning teachers. His thoughts tumbled in his head, making and breaking alliances like underpants in a dryer without cling free. That kind of works. Her vocabulary was as bad as like whatever. I love this one. From the attic came an unearthly howl. The whole scene had an eerie, surreal quality, like when you're on vacation in another city and Jeopardy comes on at 7 instead of 7:30. It's like the end of life. John and Mary had never met. They were like two hummingbirds who had also never met. Now here's the one that sort of marginally applies. He spoke with a wisdom that can only come from experience, like a guy who went blind because he looked at a solar eclipse without one of those boxes with a pinhole in it, and now goes around the country speaking at high schools about the dangers of looking at solar eclipses without one of those boxes with a pinhole in it. I guess he had to be there. Well, I said about theology of the cross on Tuesday evening, if you were here for the start of this series, that it's not so much a systematic theology or even a kind of a ground for systematics necessarily, as it is a way of doing theology, and as much as anything, it's a way of seeing, and I think it's a way of reading, and for sure it's a way of proclaiming gospel, proclaiming good news, making sure that what we say to each other in the Christian community is ultimately gospel. It looks for the presence of God in everyday life and does so, as Diane's been telling us in the Bible study, in a truth-telling way. We're able to tell the full truth. Looking for the reality of God, or looking for God in the realities of everyday life, is natural behavior, I think. I don't think it's the particular activity of any one religious tradition or even of religious people necessarily. Just for example, watch the theology of sports in our country, which is on display in every televised athletic event. Every time nowadays that someone hits a home run, they cross home plate going like that. And when they catch a touchdown pass in the Super Bowl, go down on one knee and point up. Presumably, a best case scenario, I suppose, is that that's a moment of thanks, you know, giving credit for what just happened to God. I'm not so sure God rigs the Super Bowl or fixes baseball games by deciding who's going to hit a home run when. But it is a kind of a humble thing to give credit to God. But have you ever noticed that no one ever does this when they strike out in the bottom of the ninth with the bases loaded? Or when they drop the pass in the end zone when the quarterback has thrown a Hail Mary with time expiring, or miss the shot at the buzzer on the basketball court. No one then goes. Yeah. So we have it wired that God is present when we win. God is present when we succeed. God is present when we survive the plane crash. God is present in all the times when things work out as we wanted and as we expected, and the way they would work if we were in charge of the universe. So just once, I'm waiting for some athlete to strike out. Thank God.
He'd be fired.
Yeah. When you strike out, you're supposed to go kill the Gatorade container, or whatever. I'm closest to Chicago, where we have professional Gatorade container killers. Carlos Zambrano. Like Reformation theology, theology of the cross begins with a pastoral concern. I introduced the great question, or a great question, of theology of the cross the other day as, where is God? Luther's question that led him to find and to do the things that, in a way you could say, triggered the Reformation began with the question, where can I find a gracious God? He was a pious and driven man, but he could not find in his experience or in what the church taught him a gracious God. He was tormented. He was brutally honest about his internal life as well as his external life. And everything that he did, to my way of reading the 16th century texts finally, came to a kind of moment of clarity in one of the confessional documents of the Lutheran tradition, namely the fourth article of the Apology to the Augsburg Confession. After they had made their confession before the emperor on June 25th to 1530, and the emperor fell asleep during the middle of it and said, you know, this will never do. You need to write a defense of this. And Philip Melanchthon then sat down and trotted out his theological toolbox. He wrote this thing that I find as sort of the central hermeneutical piece of the Lutheran Reformation tradition, but it also serves to me personally as the way I keep myself at least somewhat clear in trying to do theology of the cross. Melanchthon wrote that here's how you can tell genuine gospel from stuff that isn't. Genuine gospel honors the death of Christ and comforts penitent hearts. Anything that doesn't honor the death of Christ by treating it as totally necessary and totally sufficient might be a really interesting message, but it's not the gospel. And anything that doesn't comfort penitent hearts can't be gospel, no matter how clever it is. The gospel is good news. It is a message that says, in light of what happened on the cross, there is no place you could ever end up except in God's hands. That's the good news. And to honor the death of Christ and to comfort penitent hearts. So let's tackle some text together, particularly some texts that lend themselves to a different kind of theology, what Luther called a theology of glory, which is really nothing more than a theology of our own expectations. Theology by which we can prove ourselves right, theology by which we can get what we ourselves want, and theology that rewards us for being good, gets us healed and vindicated in ways that we want, gives us power because we deserve it, a theology that allows us to know the will of God based on what we observe around us. All of that, Luther says, is theology of glory. And just a couple of pieces of scripture that I think lead us, or give us a kind of groundwork for doing this that we're not going to study, but that I take as crucial elements of all this. To me, the temptation stories in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke are extremely important. I never teach a course in the Gospels back home without including this piece, the temptation story, because the temptation in the wilderness at the beginning of Jesus' ministry is really the temptation for Jesus to, in the language I'm using this morning, to act out what we expect from a theology of glory. To fix the world by giving us plenty of everything, including food. To make sure that nothing terrible could ever happen to us. So we could even fall off the precipice of the temple and we'd be okay. Unless, of course, we had our 70 years and 10 and maybe a bonus, and then it might not be so bad. But no more dying young. No more burying our children. And finally, even if it takes one more act of violence, take over the world. Run it. Be the benign dictator that the world has always needed. And Jesus says no to all this. He's not going to fix the world in that way. What does he do? He sets his face towards Jerusalem, and he goes the way of the cross. What we see when he gets there requires a reading. What happens when he gets there, of course, is he gets crucified. And one thing we need to learn to do is to see the crucifixion itself as good news. I mean, we do, after all, call that day Good Friday. We usually act really sad. And we sing the soberest, most somber songs that we know on that day. And we drape our sanctuaries in black. We have services with the lights out and so forth and so forth. But we do call it Good Friday. At the risk of sounding crazy, I think what we really need to do is to learn to see that story as a joke. A joke on us, and particularly on us as people in a world that expects to be saved in a different way. That expects the kind of salvation that the tempter offered. In Mark, it's pure irony. It's not quite as funny as it is in Luke and in John. It's just irony. It's in that moment that Jesus dies that the curtain of the temple is torn in two and the centurion says, "Oh, well, this was the Son of God." But in Luke's gospel, as I was saying the other night, you have these Jesus and this other guy hanging there crucified, making plans. This guy says, "Can I be your lieutenant, King?" Jesus. You know, who knows what that? I mean, gallows humor is weird. Crucified guys probably said crazy stuff all the time. And the one guy was taunting Jesus, saying, "Hey, you know, you saved everybody else. Why don't you get us down from here?" And the other guy says, "Yeah, Jesus. Hey, King, you with the king thing over your head, can I be your right-hand man?" Jesus says, "Yeah, buddy, sure, today, you and me. Let's do it." He doesn't say, "Well, someday, when this is all over." He says, "No, it's now, today. This is it." In John's gospel, John almost beats us over the head with the big joke. You know, if you really understand what's going on in John, Jesus tells Pontius Pilate, "You will make me king. You will say it." And Pilate, the operative for the empire, goes ahead and completes the ceremony for introducing a new king or emperor to the people, and he will not be stopped. People try to slow him down at this, but he will not be stopped. He takes Jesus out and says, he would have said it in Latin perhaps, "Ecce homo, behold the man," which is how you introduced the new emperor. And then he robes him. I mean, granted, you know, this is all very, it's got this touch of irony. It's a crown of thorns, it's a purple robe that they got from who knows where, and so forth. But then Pilate puts that thing over his head, the king of the Jews, and in every language that was necessary for people to understand it, they say, "Don't write the king of the Jews, but write that he said he was the king of the Jews." And says Pilate says, "Nope, what I have written, I have written. So let it be written, so let it be done. I insist." Pilate's doing what Jesus told him. He's following Jesus' orders, and he's making Jesus the new emperor in an age when Christians are being persecuted because they won't accept the emperor as God. And so John's gospel presents Jesus as dying death by exaltation. And Jesus himself keeps describing this as the hour of his glory. This is a big joke, friends. They were supposed to be going around saying, "Kaiser Kyrios, Caesar is Lord." But no, the Christians insisted on saying, "Jesus is Lord." And do you know what kind of joke that sounded like in the ancient world? The crucified guy reigns over the universe? Well, again, I guess you had to be there. This is a joke. It's a joke on the empire. It's a joke on all of our presuppositions about power and glory. This is the moment of exaltation and glory. This is the way the kingdom of God arrives. And it's not just a little stage you have to go through in order to get to the good stuff. This is the glory. This is it. You know, that what I'm going to rant now here, I can tell by my voice. You know, I think I actually grew up with a theology of glory version of Christianity. Because what I thought was that, you know, God had this perfectly reasonable system of choosing a people. I mean, I couldn't have put it in these words. But God had God had had a system of choosing the people in order to get blessing done in a world that desperately needed something besides all the curse that had been living with. And then all of a sudden, somewhere along the line, oh, and then God had given these people the commandments and all the laws in order to, you know, give them the program for how to do this or something like that. I was taught that they had turned all this into a kind of religion of works righteousness, so that they went ahead and took the law and tried to earn their way into God's favor, which they already had because they were God's people, so they had screwed that up. But anyway, then all of a sudden with Jesus, God changed the whole thing into a children's game of password. So that it wasn't anymore about being God's people and or anything like that, but it was like a game of password, or like that stupid show that was on TV when I was a kid where Groucho Marx knew the secret word. And if unless you said the secret word, you wouldn't get the prize for the day. And if you knew the secret word, Jesus, then you got saved. But if you didn't have the password, you were out. So that Christianity was a matter of having the right password and getting in the club. And if you didn't have the right password, well, sorry, you're out. So that's a crass way to put it, but that's sort of the way Christianity was presented to me, so that it was finally something that I did. I got it right. Those other benighted blokes out there somewhere didn't, so we're on the inside, they're on the outside. Too bad, but we got the password. That's how it was presented. Well, it's against that tradition that I'm then doing all this rereading. The gospel is not that if you know the password, you get in on the goodies. The gospel is that God has entered into the reality of our everyday life, including the darkest and smelliest and most desperate of all those moments, and that's where God stays as long as we're there. As long as we're still there, that's where God chooses to hang out. Well, back to Luke here for a moment. In the resurrection narrative, when Jesus is raised from the dead, those two guys who keep showing up in the Lucan tradition, at the Transfiguration, at the empty tomb, and then again at the Ascension, they come around to say to they say at the tomb, it was necessary that the Messiah should suffer. And then Jesus, when he shows up at Emmaus and stays for dinner on the road as he did Bible study for them, he says to them, "Oh, how foolish you are and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things?" Okay, now we got to start rereading, because here's what that NRSV says. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory? And then beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. There's a bit of theology of glory has crept into the NRSV, right, in this very verse that's supposed to be about the theology of the cross. Did you hear this? Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory? The word, any Greek word meaning then, is not in that text. It's just not there. The Greek says, I'm not going to read it in Greek, I'm just going to read this to you as literally as I can do it. Were not these things necessary to suffer for the Christ? And, or better word order for English-speaking people would be, was it not necessary that the Christ suffer these things and enter into his glory. Those two things are all one thing in the Greek. To suffer and to enter into glory is a pair of things that were necessary. There's not a word for then in there. Now listen to the King James got it right. The King James Version said, ought not Christ to have suffered these things and to enter his glory? The RSV said, was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter his glory? It was the NIV that introduced the then. The NIV is the first translation ever to put. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory, as though they're separate and consequential? And the NRSV chose to follow the NIV. If we're in tune with the other Gospels, the simplest translation from the old days was perfectly sufficient. Suffering and entering glory are not separate stages. So shame on the NIV and NRSV. A parade example of a text that can be read from a theology of glory perspective, but in my estimation shouldn't be, is the first one we'll look at together for a few minutes. Would you, if you have a Bible, turn to Matthew 15, verses 21 to 28. This story is also in Mark. Matthew has most likely taken it from Mark. I'm choosing to read it in Matthew instead of in Mark because Matthew makes it look even worse than it already looks in Mark. Jesus left that place and went away to the district of Tyre and Sidon. Just then a Canaanite woman from that region came out and started shouting, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon." But he did not answer her at all. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she keeps shouting after us." He answered, "Well, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." He answered, "It is not fair to take the children's food and to throw it to the dogs." I mean, there's not, you could hardly say it any more plainly. You are not one of the children, lady. You are a dog. What I have is not for you. She said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Jesus answered her, "Woman, great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed instantly. Okay, now, I have gotten in enormous trouble for writing about this text, and less so when just preaching about it, because people don't have time to figure out how to respond. But I also have a kind of instinctive need to explain Jesus. Now, don't you? I mean, what's your first reaction to the way Jesus behaves here?
He's very mean.
Well, it's mean. This is mean. This is racist speech. Jesus calling this woman a dog, which is what, of course, they called the Samaritans. You know, the history of the way Jews and Samaritans and Canaanites and all these other people talked about one another is horrible. This is Walter Kowalski from the movie the other night. Jesus as Walt. Only he's not calling her a gook or a slope or a zipperhead, but a dog. And we don't like hearing racial epithets on the lips of Jesus. And so the usual explanation is to go straight to theology of glory and say, well, he was testing her to see how she would act. And she passed the test and humbled herself before him and then therefore earned his favor. That's the theology of glory reading. There's another way to read this text. And that is to understand, this takes some sort of crashing of all sorts of theological presuppositions that most of us grow up with about Jesus. But Jesus here is speaking in the language of his contemporaries. He is speaking in the theology of his people. He is a Jew. And what the Jews had was not for the Gentiles. It was for them. It was for the Jews. And this woman was an outsider. She wasn't even a full human being. Like in most other ancient languages, the word for our people, Am, in Hebrew, means human being. Goy, the nations, means all the rest of them. The word Cheyenne means human being. So there were the Cheyenne, and then there was everybody else. In their language, we are human. They're something else. That's what you learn. And Jesus simply speaks in the language of his people. And this woman, I'm going to try to hurry through this now because I want to do some other things too. This woman, if you'll pardon the quick shift, she nails him. Something about what she does crucifies him out there on the rope. She nails the theology that he grew up with. And it dies out there. He dies out there. He dies to the theology that insists she's not a person. And he ends up in her place. He ends up outside. And if you know how both this story and Mark work, you know that this meal of crumbs that she's willing to have, she doesn't say, oh yes, I am a human being and I deserve, a meal at the table just like everybody else. She says, I take crumbs. Making him look even more foolish in an old honor shame culture. The thing he's done just before this is to feed the 5,000 in his own territory. The next thing he does is to feed the 4,000 in her territory. Now the Messianic banquet is for Gentiles too. This is the moment when his ministry shifts. In Matthew, he's made it very clear up to this point, we are after the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That was the mission on which he put the disciples. That's what he says his own mission is. This woman is an instrument for killing that. He got nailed out there. And from now on, the Gentiles are at the dinner too. That's a kind of theology of the cross reading of this stuff. I'll keep going. I know this could probably raise all sorts of questions in your mind, but I'd like to get to a couple of other texts because I think the texts that depict for us the world set right are some of the most instructive ones to look at. And to learn how to reread. I've done this one up here at Holden several other times in different contexts. Would you turn for a moment to one of the most beautiful passages in our canon, Isaiah 25, verses 6 and following, the banquet on the mountain. This is in a way to take what we just witnessed back in Matthew, although this is the pre-vision. We read this on Easter Sunday on at least one of the 3 years in the lectionary cycle. We read it also on Proper 23 in the year A, along with another banquet story, which maybe we'll get to. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, a rich food filled with marrow, of well-aged wine strained clear, and he will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all peoples, the sheet that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. Then the Lord God will wipe away the tears from all faces, and the disgrace of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. It will be said on that day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him so that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation. And that's where we stop. It's Isaiah 25, 6 to 9. That's the end of the reading. What a glorious vision. And it gets used, as I'll show you in a few minutes, elsewhere, that vision in Christian eschatology. But that's not the whole vision. That's only part of it. If you really want to understand what Isaiah's vision was, and the vision of the old tradition that needs to be nailed and crucified, keep reading. For the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain, and there's no break in the text in the Hebrew like there is in a lot of English Bibles that try to keep us from seeing what follows by separating it into a different section. In the Hebrew, it just keeps going. But the Moabites shall be trodden down in their place, as straw is trodden down in a dung pit. Though they spread out their hands in the midst of it, as swimmers spread out their hands to swim, their pride will be laid low despite the struggle of their hands. The high fortifications of his walls shall be brought down, laid low, cast to the ground, even to the dust. So there's the entire vision. We are up on the mountain having a great feast. The best wines, the fattest and most delicious of the foods. We are having our tears wiped away. We will never again be sad. But our old enemies, the Moabites, are down at the bottom of the mountain, swimming in our urine, eating our dung. And even when they try to get out, God squishes them down so that they're sure to suffer. That's the standard vision of how we want the world to turn out. We win, our enemies lose, they drink our urine and eat our dung while we celebrate.
So is that what's happening in the ball game currently?
I guess, yeah. God is with the winners, the losers can go eat. Yeah, what are we going to do with this? How do you deal with this vision? Well, to make a long story short, you know, one of the things I do is I ask where. Would we put the crucified Christ, or even the risen Christ, who always still has those wrecked hands and ruined feet. Did you ever notice that? Even post-resurrection, those never go away. He is always the crucified one, even risen. Where do you put the crucified Christ in the vision of Isaiah 25? I mean, I'm sorry, but he's not going to make the top of the mountain. If nothing else, because it says right in the genealogy that his great-great-great-great-great-great whatever grandma was Ruth the Moabite. He's got Moabite blood, among other things. I don't know how many generations it takes to clean that stuff out. But if you put Jesus at the top of the mountain, he's got relatives at the bottom. And you think he's going to like this party? A cruciform version of this scene is, there's a party all right, but the party with the crucified one is at the bottom of the mountain. I don't know exactly what they're doing up there. They got a great menu and so forth, but the messianic banquet is down below. The crucified Messiah's party is there, because that's where he got tossed. That's where he finds his glory. Which is kind of a stunning thing to think about. The crucified one never rests so long as someone is still in the dung pit. The book of Revelation picks this up in chapter 21. The same vision appears there. And so it's not just Hebrew scriptures that I think personally that we need to reread, but it's our own Christian scriptures we need to learn to reread. Revelation 21 verses 1-6, which is a text we find in our lectionary at several points. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more, borrowing from some later chapters of Isaiah. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her bridegroom. And I heard the loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them as their God. They will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more." So here's Isaiah 25. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away. And then we get continued visions of the New Jerusalem. But keep on going until you get to chapter 22. In the epilogue, verses 14 and following. Blessed are those who wash their robes, so that they will have the right to the tree of life and may enter the city by the gates. Outside are the dogs and sorcerers and fornicators and murderers and idolaters and everyone who loves and practices falsehood. That spooks me. That we have a vision of everything ending up as a big old insider-outsider scene. Inside are all the people who have washed their robes and made them white. Outside, all those other dogs, sorcerers, fornicators, murderers. Are we insiders or are we outsiders? Where are we in this picture? Well, my experience is that we are the people who have washed our robes and made them white. This is baptismal talk. I am baptized, and I know the songs of the crucified Christ, but you should hear me bark. I have a really good dog act. I bite people. And I'm not proud of this, but I love and practice falsehood. There are a lot of lives that are precious to me because they keep me afloat. You know, some of them I tell myself and some of them I tell you. I've never tried sorcery very much because I don't know how, but you know, I'm pretty good at fornication and murderer and idolater. I got to plead guilty to all that. At least if Jesus is right about how it's just as deadly in your mind and in your heart and in your eyes and all those other places as it is if you're actually committing a version you could videotape. So I don't know how to split those two groups up anymore. And where is the crucified one in this picture? He'll never stay in place among the clean. He will always find some way to go whipping off into the company of the other crowd.
Fred, isn't Revelation, though, just as confusing about that in terms of this whole section? If you go back in chapter 21, verse 24, they're all marching into the city, into the temple now. The nations, which of course would be characterized in most of the book already as, if you will, the bad guys, right? The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth, again, another sense of the bad guys, will bring their glory into it. So there you get a sense of kind of the outsiders now become the inside, or they're included. Its gates will never be shut, and so on and so forth. Verse 26, people will bring into it the glory and honor of the nations. And then, your point again, verse 27, but nothing unclean will enter it, nor anyone who practices abomination or falsehood, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. In some senses, isn't John really trying to confuse us, because on the one hand, those kind of preceding verses almost seem to say, all the outsiders now become the insiders, and yet the unclean won't get in there, but the question might be, are there any unclean left?
Yeah.
That up in terms of John seems to want to almost confuse us as much as clarify.
Yeah, perhaps so. I tend to read the Johannine corpus, particularly John and Revelation, as the work of a persecuted community. And as Susan Briel likes to say, and I agree with her, it's the work of a little group that saw itself as probably moribund, probably about to go out of existence. And they were the last little remnant of faithfulness. And everybody else, including a lot of the rest of the Christian tradition. I mean, the Gospel of John has this thing about all the Peter version of Christianity being something else than our beloved disciple taught us. And so it's possible that the Gospel of John, it's very easy and probably historically accurate in some ways to read the Gospel of John and the Book of Revelation as the work of a group that was comforting itself in what it perceived to be its last days. and the whole world was against them, and so it's a very polarized, apocalyptic vision. And you know, they used this to comfort themselves. I mean, last week or something, I forgot when I was doing this up here, I'm starting to lose track. I was talking about Klaus Westermann. It was in Vespers a couple of weeks ago. I was telling the story of how Klaus Westermann was in a concentration camp when he was a graduate student. And he had been memorizing the Psalms, and he was so grateful when he was in the concentration camp that he had memorized so many of the Psalms, because they weren't allowed to have any books or anything. And he actually not only prayed, but he studied the Psalms in the concentration camp while his back and his hands were shoveling, digging ditches. His mind was studying the Psalms. And he actually wrote his book on the form criticism of the Psalms in his mind and then put it on paper after he was free. And it's still the classic work on form criticism of the Psalms. But he is also the one from whom I learned. He said through all his graduate work, he had always found the book of Revelation to just be inscrutable and impossible and not worth much until he was in the concentration camp. And in the concentration camp in that world, the book of Revelation was a great comfort to him, the insiders and the outsiders, us and them. It helped get him through. But once you get out of the concentration camp and you're still putting the world into us versus them categories, and you have all the power, and now your enemy is without power, are you still going to use Revelation? Or don't you finally need, in some way or another, to crucify the vision of the end time in which you have all the power, and now you can keep the Moabites in the toilet, or whoever? So yeah, Revelation is confusing, but you know, finding a way to honor the death of Christ as totally necessary and totally sufficient, and comfort penitent hearts, that's the goal. Was that the lunch bell? Yes. We'll take a few more minutes with your permission to at least go an hour. I think, given where I started us on this on Tuesday, we should think about where is the crucified church, the ecclesia crucis. This isn't just about where is Jesus. It's about where do we, the baptized, find ourselves? What is our mission? You know, I already hinted at how I would redefine the image of the great party. The really great party, if Isaiah 25 is our vision, is, you know, somehow or another, we're going to have the party, at least for now. As long as some folks are still outsiders, we'll have the party out in the street somewhere, in the dung pit. We'll find our way to take the party there. That's one way to put it. And if you want an interesting text in order to think about what this looks like in the New Testament, I would take you to Matthew 18, takes me half an hour to reread this one in total. Matthew 18 is the great forgiveness chapter in Matthew that toward the beginning has the parable of the shepherd with the one lost sheep, and it's the parable in which the shepherd will not rest if even one sheep is still lost. risks the 99 in the wilderness to go cruising after the one stupid idiot that's always screwing up and getting lost, wasting our time, risking everything, but we cannot rest until every sheep is found, then the party can commence. Then we get the, if your brother or sister sins against you, go and point out the fault and all that. I worked through this in my Bible studies a week or so ago. We end up with a fault line between us, different continents become our homes, and somebody needs, if we're ever going to be together again, somebody needs to jump the fault line and just go over to the wrong continent and have the party there. At least that's how I read it. So that when you get to the point that you've tried everything, you've spoken to a person individually, you've gotten two or three together, you take it to the whole congregation, it still doesn't work, and if everything else fails, well then finally you treat them like a tax collector and a Gentile. Which, in theology of glory, means you write them off, say, the hell with them, what do you expect from tax collectors and Gentiles? That's not theology of the cross. Theology of the cross, I mean, where does Jesus spend his time? But with tax collectors and Gentiles. So it doesn't mean write them off. It means if they go out there and they're not coming to the supper anymore, then I'm afraid we're going to be eating in a lot of weird restaurants for a while. Because we need to be out there where they are, saying, come with me, somehow or another, so that it's convincing. Because the whole chapter is about saying convincing speech that recreates community. So the crucified church does not sit in its own little circle saying, aren't we glad we're right and pure? Too bad about the other suckers. All those people who practice this, that, and the other thing. And you could name the list of what are the big bugaboos these days. I'm so glad we're right. That's absolutely not the crucified church. The crucified church is out there restless as the crucified one. The one with the hands and feet full of holes, walking the roads of Emmaus, talking to crushed people. So, you know, I got a whole bunch of other stories I love to turn upside down like that, you know. But it's 8 minutes to 12. Do you have any questions, comments? If you want to charge me with heresy, you need to get in line. Plenty more ahead of you.
Yeah. I'm just curious, do you think God requires violence? Does that fit with the theology of the cross?
No, God does not require violence, but theology of the cross does account for the fact that violence happens. Violence happens. Theology of the cross does not glorify violence. It does not glorify suffering. It does not, in fact, say suffering is redemptive, and it certainly does not say violence is redemptive. But it acknowledges the fact that that stuff happens in the world. And Christ takes even that on. Christ endures even that. And if you find yourself the victim of violence and suffering, it does not mean you are abandoned by God, which is what we think. Because we're only going like this when we hit home runs. The theology of the cross says, even in those moments, you are not abandoned. God is with you. Another precious text to me for practicing theology of the cross is when Jesus says, look, I come for people who need a physician. If your life is perfect right now, I don't have much for you. But in the day that you get nailed, and friends, that day is coming for every single one of us. If it's, you know, if it's not now, it'll be later. Sooner or later, you're going to get, something is going to get you and throw you into what seems to be the utter absence of God. And when you land there, that's the moment that you look around and say, look who got here first. The crucified one was here to meet me when I got here. I am not abandoned. That to me is the gospel. Not that if I'm good and if I'm strong, I can cling to God and God will be faithful to me, but that even when I totally lose my grip, God will not let go of me. And that's what I see in the crucifixion. Even there, He is Lord for me. That's the gospel. So, exactly how do you turn that into a systematic theology? I don't know, but it sure works for preaching. Anything else? Well, I guess I should say amen.